Music seeking, screaming as it seeks resolution and finding none. Britain's Violin Concerto performed here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, by Janine Jansen with the Orchestre de Paris, conducted by Pavel Yerby. The winding round the major and minor scale at the end of the concerto makes you think of Gypsy or Jewish music. Was Britain thinking of the way both those minorities were under threat in 1939? Seems very possible. Wonderful orchestration too. The young Briton, 25 when he completed the concerto, never covering the solo violin. Britain regarded at the time he left for America as a brilliant but rather superficial composer. He began to believe it himself, was even surprised to find when the concerto was revived towards the end of his life, but he thought it a much better piece than he'd been led to believe. The two artists coming back onto the stage now, Janine Jansen and Pavel Yerby. I think it's a masterpiece. I think they've proved it. She's such a collaborative artist. She's always playing with the orchestra, turning around, enjoying the rhythms, playing with them. The trombones and tuba being brought to their feet, those who start the Passacaglia. The beginning of that long last movement. Then the horns and the wind section. And the percussion. Harp and strings. Very concentrated from Pavel Yerby, very hard for the orchestra as well, of course. But now the smile creeping over his face, just mouthed wonderful at Janine as they finished the concerto. She says it's extremely challenging with all that very fast double stopping and of course the stratospheric writing and the passion and intensity and commitment she shows, you've just heard. Enjoys working with this orchestra and this conductor and opens their season at the Salle Pleyel in Paris with Prokofiev's second concerto on the 11th of this month. Back they come onto the platform. Meantime, she's playing Bach violin concertos and sonatas with her dad, in fact, touring to London in December. The CD of that's just come out. Perhaps piano trios, Brahms and Weinberg at Wigmore Hall. We're back in this country a lot, which is only good. Pavel Yerby brings the Orchestre de Paris to its feet as he and Janine Jansen take the applause here in the Royal Albert Hall. Wonderful way you can hear a pin drop in the quietest moments. When I left the Royal College of Music earlier this evening after the Proms Plus, I was met by an elderly gentleman who, not in this hall, of course, in the Queen's Hall, had heard the first performance of Britain's Piano Concerto, with Britain himself the soloist in 1938. He wished he could remember more about it. I hope he's enjoyed this tonight. Paul Kilday, who was one of the people talking down at the College of Music, says this was Britain's breakthrough piece. No longer the brilliant young man, but this is where Britain's soul comes through for the first time. Well, after the interval, which I think we all need, the Orchestre de Paris will return to the platform in the Albert Hall with its music director, Pavel Yerby, to perform French music. Berlioz's great curtain raiser, the Corsair Overture, and one of the pillars of 19th century French symphonic tradition, Saint-Saëns' Third Symphony, the Organ Symphony, in which the soloist will be Thierry Escaich. But before we move across the channel, for the next 20 minutes here on Radio 3, we stay with Benjamin Britten and head, as I said, for the Royal College of Music, where a little earlier I hosted a Proms Plus discussion about the great man. Please welcome the conductor and author Paul Kilday and Sir Nicholas Kenyon, former controller of the BBC Proms, now managing director of the Barbican Centre, where there'll be a 2-week Britain Festival in November. Please welcome them both. Can I start by asking you both what Britain's music means to you? Nick?
I'm not a Britain expert in any sense, but Britain's music has always been with me from really quite an early age. As a Catholic choir boy, I was lucky enough to come to London and take part in a summer school at Westminster Cathedral, and there we sang Britain's Missa Brevis, which he had written for the choir there, conducted by George Malcolm. And from that time on, I think Britain's music was always with me. I would say among all the sensations of 20th century music, all the amazing things that you can get out of the music of that century, Britain's is the most personal and humane statement. He takes you to what people feel like. And I think that, I would say, is what his music really means to me.
Paul?
I mean, I got to that position eventually, but growing up in Australia, we didn't hear very much of it. And the bit that we did hear, I sort of liked the sound of. And so when you like the sound of something, you become more and more interested in who the person was that made it. And so then I became interested in the pieces and this darkness and the themes that he explored within the music. And it's the great Bernstein line that, you know, where he said that when you hear this music underneath the surface, and not terribly far beneath the surface, you hear these gears not quite meshing, and it makes this sort of dark sound. And so that interested me. And then finally, I wanted to work out who this man was, this extraordinary entrepreneur that was determined to do things his own way and also not take the institutions or the infrastructures as they stood as the benchmark for performance in England post-war. And so that became, to me, almost like a treasure hunt. Who is this?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, you've written a new biography of Britain. I mean, what post-biography would you say are the most salient points of his personality?
Very thin-skinned, yeah. A perfectionist, a very hard worker, almost a Calvinist, with a deep sensitivity and response to the English language in particular, but some other poets as well, and a determination to have his own way on everything. And if you bring all of that together, you have really quite a force in a composer.
So why did he head for America in the late 30s? I mean, as a young composer, did he feel underappreciated here?
Well, I think we have to go back a bit here. He was, and I think Paul's absolutely right, an incredibly practical, driven composer. And in the 30s, you find him doing a lot of things which you wouldn't naturally associate with someone who wants to become a great composer, in quotes, doing a lot of film music, radio music, all those GPO films, which actually are remarkable documents, but you wouldn't necessarily regard them as musically the weightiest things that you could be doing. And he then becomes involved with a whole circle of people, which somehow leads him ineluctably to the States. And it was not a question of getting away from the war. I'm absolutely sure about that. And indeed, he came back during it. Paul, you know far more about this than I do, but I would describe it as a cultural thing.
Completely. I mean, I always get into trouble saying this because, of course, whatever I'm about to say, things were far worse in Australia in the 1930s. So let me say that to begin with. But the level of performance in England in the 1930s was very variable, often rather poor. And Britain found himself, from his late teens, just describing the standard of performance in this country as being incredibly low. And when in 1934, at the end of the year, he goes and visits Vienna for the first time, and experiences the Vienna Philharmonic, he then goes, oh, okay, I was right. Yeah. And of course, the thing to remember is that because of the tragedies of Jewish emigration in the 1930s, the standard of performance in America with these really, really great orchestras was much higher. And so he was sort of drawn into that as well.
So when he returned, I mean, was much of the American influence, did that impinge on his writing when he got back in 42?
The period 39 to 42 is really interesting because this is the time where he really reaches his stride as a composer. And it's almost as though he had finally in America the space and the resources really to think and to compose and to have performances under conductors of really high stature with which and with whom he was satisfied. And so he brings that experience back, that space, back to England in 1942. And of course, there's none of that infrastructure really. And there's an ingrained hostility within the institutions like the BBC, I hate to say, towards this gay, his conscientious objection got him into trouble. And so you have this hostility from various staff conductors towards Britten and his music. Doesn't worry him so much. He withdraws. He's working on Peter Grimes and doing his own touring around the country with Seema and with Peter Pears. So this is the start of him really, if you like, controlling the product.
It's worth bearing in mind that in that sequence of events, the rather unhappy episode of him giving the premiere of his piano concerto at the Proms in 1938, as usual in those days, rather under-rehearsed, rather ill-prepared. He didn't get on very well with Henry Wood. It didn't really make the impression that he hoped that it would. Yeah. And I think that fits exactly into what Paul's saying. It is, I really recommend that you read the diaries now that John Evans has edited them, because the comments he makes about performances during the 30s are really wonderfully acerbic. The performance was only a Kensington drawing room apology for the wild, sensuous and beautiful music. Performance was scandalous, without style and taste, string playing as dead as nails. and those things recur really quite often. And so you get this feeling that Britten wants to take matters into his own hands. And here he is, a composer who really cares about performance and how his music sounds.
Paul, you mentioned Peter Grimes. I get the feeling that when he arrived back in 1942 and things were not all rosy for him at all, that opera was crucial to the perception of Britten as a composer.
Yeah, not least because all the people that had been throwing things at him in the period 42 to 45 suddenly had to go, oh, okay, he might actually know a thing. It's quite good music. So that really does shift things. But it's worth remembering as well, almost as Nick's just said, that the standard of performance of Peter Grimes was not very good. And this was grist to Britten's mill from 45 onwards, that he had to somehow control things. So he was determined not just to be in charge of the music that he wrote, but also the way it was performed, and in some senses then trying to control the reaction to it.
And isn't that what then gave the Aldborough Festival, when it started, such a strong character? Because it was not just about Britten's music, it was about Britten's repertory. Yes. And so you had his music set against that background of the composers that he valued and drew so much from, whether it was Schubert or Mozart or Purcell, Monteverdi, and it was a completely characterful set of music in distinction to the barnstorming popular repertory that was then dominant at the Proms of the 50s with Malcolm Sargent.
That's absolutely true. And it's also worth stressing that early on, so the Aldborough Festival has its inaugural festival in 1948, early on, Britten really didn't think that this was a place just to showcase his music. He made it very clear that this was not an English Bayreuth, and that the programming interests that he had at this stage. And it's only in the 1960s when he starts to withdraw from the metropolitan scene, even more than had been the case in the 1950s, that you see him really putting all of his energies into performances of his own music and if you like, the authentic performance or the authentic experience of his own music in Aldborough.
Didn't he withdraw earlier in the mid-50s because of partly of the horrible experience of Gloriana at Covent Garden?
Yes, but you still have him trying, and you still have Covent Garden trying to lure him into a much stronger relationship.
So, Paul, I was Talking to Mark Padmore at the Billy Budd performance, or before the Billy Budd performance, about the outsiders in Britain's operas, what about Britain himself? I mean, we've just been talking about, he seems partly an outsider looking in who wants to be an establishment figure, and then on the other hand, you know, when he's in Aldeburgh, he's an establishment figure who perhaps wants to be an outsider. Where is he? What does he want to be?
He never resolves this at all. And in some ways, that conflict is what drives both his life and his repertory. And it certainly drives his selection of subjects, particularly in the operas, but in some ways also the songs. And it's really interesting. If you look at, you know, he was so sort of close to W. H. Auden in the mid 30s, to around the fiasco of Paul Bunyan in 1941. And Auden, sort of one of the motivations for Auden leaving England in 1938 was that he'd just won the King's Medal for poetry. And he later wrote about that experience, and he just sort of said, I knew I had to leave, because if I didn't, I would be, you know, sucked up completely into the establishment. And I didn't want that. And he felt as though he could only write the poetry and have the thoughts if he were outside the establishment. Whereas Britain actually thinks that he can have it both ways, that he can have tea with the Queen Mother all the while he's writing, you know, Death in Venice or Billy Budd, or one of the great damning indictments of establishment culture, if you like, which is the War Requiem. So he really felt as though he could have both, and no one ever called him out on it, which is, I find, very interesting.
Nick, did he feel his music was judged differently because he was gay?
Because he was gay, I think that lies behind his position as insider or outsider, to the extent that he was, in that sense, as a homosexual, an outsider in society. And that almost was why he overcompensated, I think, by retaining the Queen's English to that extraordinary extent that you hear on the interviews, rehearsing in a jacket and tie, invariably, and becoming part of a social circle which supported him. But at Aldeburgh, it was so important to him that he had a social circle that completely supported him and never questioned him. And that was what led to many of the difficult conflicts, because I think for him, for all his personal understanding of people, the work always came first. And so if a few people had to be sacrificed in the cause for great performances of his works in the way that he wanted them to be heard, that had to be. It was sort of inevitable. And of course, he then becomes more and more at the centre, which previously he had disrupted from the outside. Here he is moving right into the centre of our musical life. And I would actually say the War Requiem, around that time, is the moment when that happens.
Just going back to Britain the performer, you mentioned his Proms not-so-happy debut in 1938. How important was it to him to be a performer?
It was part of his almost soul. That's a funny way of saying it, but I get into trouble when I say that the Britain was the consummate 20th century musician, because then people attack me and say, but what about Stravinsky? But I'm actually more interested in this, you know, what Percy Grainger called the you know, the all-rounded man, and that's what Britain was. He was an absolute consummate performer.
We've both mentioned that the War Requiem, in 1963, of course, Britain was 50, and there were wide-ranging celebrations. And Rostropovich said, I can say that when you and I are no longer here, millions of ordinary people will still be celebrating your birthdays, your 125th, 150th, and 200th. So he was quite prescient. But how did Britain respond to this, to these celebrations?
He couldn't bear it, and he thought the BBC was taking it all a little bit over the top. But some part of him thought that he was touched. Don't forget, this is 1963. It's after the War Requiem. You know, he's really withdrawing now. And so he found the public celebrations a little too much. But there's a wonderful comment that he made about Figaro. And he just sort of said, it's really interesting looking at an opera like Figaro, and Mozart's writing about Figaro or the Countess or whatever, and you get the impression that he doesn't even know that these characters are going to be with us forever, and that they're going to mean something to us forever. And he at this time was saying, look, we all get worked up about writing masterpieces. You know, who knows if my music's going to be played in 10 years or 20 years. And I find that the parallel between the comment he made about Mozart and the way that we look at some of his characters in his operas and the moral and the message in those works are overwhelming.
Nick, what about his reputation for the last dozen or so years of his life? I mean, it was slightly mixed. I mean, there were some people who were...
Oh, yes, and for longer. I mean, you would have to say that the most wonderful thing about him is how he kept his nerve musically. It was a time of aggressive modernism, where there was a whole school of music critics who would not accept that what Britain was doing was useful or in the mainstream. And on the other side, there was a whole reversion to a pre-war quasi-tonal world, and Britain didn't fit into that either. So essentially, he absolutely pursued a single line of beauty, one could call it, and that resulted in, I think, the real long lastingness of his music since his death. There has not been a dip, as there has been, for instance, with the work of Michael Tippett. There's been an absolutely consistent growth, which this centenary year has really set the seal on.
Paul, what did younger composers say about Britain towards the end of his life, and the other way around, who did Britain particularly respect amongst other composers?
Well, he really did respect Tippett, yeah. Even though he thought that some of Tippett's music was a little rough around the edges. But other than that, he had huge respect for his masters, and Nick mentioned, you know, Schubert, Monteverdi, Mahler, and then he liked younger composers, and so in the late 60s he had a sort of a nice guardian angel relationship with people like Ollie Nussen and Robert Saxton, and because he didn't teach and felt slightly that he had no time for it, and then guilt that came from not taking some responsibility for the next generation. But you have also, and I think this is a segue to what Nick was saying, that one of the things I wanted to do in my book was to reclaim the late period from about 1970 to 1976, because he was so ill, and the music was caught up in this sort of narrative of decline, and so people would look at him, and he looked so unwell, and indeed he was very unwell. And they'd think, oh, well, the music is thin and doesn't have much substance. But I actually think the music from 1970 onwards has an incredible sort of palette and urgency to it, and especially from 1974 onwards. This man who would think about works for a very long time, you know, and plan them in his head. In 1974, he realizes he's not going to get better, having been told that, you know, the heart operation the year before would leave him completely well again and able to conduct and all those sort of things. And at the end of the year, he finds out he's not going to get better, and that makes this urgency sort of, you know, really, really kick in. And he writes works, you know, of extraordinary sort of quality, pieces like Phaedra and pieces like, you know, Praise We Great Men that he was writing at the end. And these have a radiance and a beauty and about them that I think needs to be revealed.
And I think the continuing success and growth of appreciation of Death in Venice has been absolutely crucial to that and to his reputation after his death. But a time there was, Phaedra, third-string quartet. These are astonishing pieces.
So since 1976, has it been a steady climb in his reputation here in the UK, Paul, do you say?
Yes. The funny thing I think about Britain in England or Britain in Great Britain is that people have since the 1940s tried to ascertain his significance rather than his meaning, and trying to work out where he stands and what his position is, rather than just saying, okay, these are works of enormous power and relevance, and this idea of relevance, particularly in this century, is what drives their popularity. And so when people let that go and just sort of went, oh, okay, we're dealing now with this body of works that are performed throughout the world and that are recognized throughout the world for their power and for their message, English people, I think, have become far more relaxed about the music itself and about saying, okay, this is really important stuff.
is a large part of his oeuvre now making its way around the world, Nick?
We certainly know that the operas in particular are travelling very widely indeed, because I think his achievement in opera in the post-war world is so distinct from that of a whole range of operas that haven't established themselves that has been the main way in which his reputation has advanced. Many, many stimulating new productions, new ideas, and a lot of conductors not born and bred in the Britain tradition who are now taking him up.
Well, I'm afraid that is where we have to end it. Thank you very much for coming. And my thanks to Nick Kenyon and Paul Kilday for their insights into the life and music of the great man, the 100th anniversary of whose birth we're celebrating, Benjamin Britten. And that Proms Plus intro was recorded earlier this evening down the steps at the Royal College of Music. The producer was Janet Tuppen. And there'll be much more about Britten here on Radio 3 during our centenary weekend in November. Welcome back from me, Martin Handley, live again here in the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom, in which the Orchestre de Paris is conducted by its music director, Paavo Järvi. I asked him how he would describe his orchestra and their sound.
They have a very particular sound, which I find very attractive. It is a sort of nice combination of a good German sound, because they have had a long history of German music directors. But at the same time, they also are all, pretty much without exception, French, and with a French schooling. So there is this real natural affinity for the type of nuance which no German orchestra could ever get. The type of nuance which you cannot explain, that this sort of sensuousness that sort of happens between piano and pianissimo, not just about the dynamics, but how one gets from note to the note. So there's something which I hope you'll hear tonight that makes their sound very special. Of course, this is easier to achieve in French music and in a repertoire that asks for that and asks for that type of color.
And they're just the qualities that Paavo Järvi thinks are required for the main work in this second half, Saint-Saëns' Third Symphony, the Organ Symphony. But the Orchestre de Paris begins with Berlioz and an overture full of Byronic flair, Le Corsaire. The composer, being told by his doctor after the breakup of his first marriage, he needed to get away from it all to recover from his physical and nervous exhaustion. The place he chose was Nice, where he stayed in a tower overlooking a glorious view of the Mediterranean. And exhausted or not, the majority of the overture that Berlioz wrote there could hardly be more frenetic. Berlioz first called it La Tour de Nice for obvious reasons, but later changed the title to reflect the writings of first Fenimore Cooper and then Byron. Admittedly, Byron's poem, The Corsair, fascinated Berlioz, but this overture is really far more to do with the atmosphere of Nice and the Mediterranean as seen from his tower. Well, as you might expect of a Parisian orchestra, I should say they're very sartorially elegant. Black collarless jackets for the gentlemen. Neat black dresses and trousers for the ladies. Anyway, it's a very Parisian sight, dare I say it. And here comes Paavo Järvi. Rejoining his orchestra, the Orchestre de Paris, here in the Royal Albert Hall, to conduct Berlioz's overture, Le Corsaire. Thank you. Plenty of piratical swagger in Berlioz's overture Le Corsaire, performed to open the second part of this prom live on Radio 3 by the Orchestre de Paris, conducted by Paavo Järvi. As salt a sea piece as has ever been written, said Donald Tovey. Well, as Paavo Järvi was saying, it's a relatively young orchestra, founded in 1967, and first music director Charles Münch, but then Herbert von Karajan, Scholte, Barenboim, Semyon Bychkov, Christoph von Arnagny, Christoph Eschenbach, and since 2010. The man coming back onto the platform now, Paavo Järvi, who brought the wind section to its feet with all that chattering and atmospheric wind. And now all the complete orchestra on its feet. And so to Saint-Saëns and his third symphony, the Organ Symphony. When Liszt died in 1886, it was a great blow to his friend and admirer Saint-Saëns, who'd first met him when still a teenager. Saint-Saëns dedicated the symphony he was composing to his friend. He'd been commissioned by the Philharmonic Society of London, to whose secretary Saint-Saëns wrote, "It'll be terrifying. I warn you, this imp of a symphony has gone up half a tone. It didn't want to stay in B minor and is now in C minor. It'll be a treat for me to conduct it." And he did indeed conduct the premiere at St. James's Hall here in London the following year. In a way, the symphony is a summing up of Saint-Saëns's musical personality, his conservatism, leavened by the progressive style of Liszt and by his own French wit and his taste for the charming.
Saint-Saëns, even himself, he said, "I am the number one among the second-rate composers." Nothing can be further from truth. I think that his best works are truly masterpieces, but the problem with Saint-Saëns is that he incorporates still a Germanic thinking, symphonic thinking. At that time, very few people were writing symphonies anymore, and everything that had to do with a kind of a structural similarity to the German music was looked down upon. So I think that he tried to find the perfect balance between the two worlds. And when you listen to this symphony, there is a clear symphonic structure, but there is no doubt that this is written by a Frenchman. It's the most sensuous, little laid-back quality to it, and yet there is majestic. Something slightly runs up and down your spine, and you don't really know what it is, but you feel it. It's glorious music.
Gounod was at the first performance of the symphony and afterwards declared Saint-Saëns to be the French Beethoven. And Saint-Saëns himself wrote of his symphony that in its two sections it contains in principle the four traditional movements. The first serves as an introduction to the adagio, the scherzo is linked by the same process to the finale. And I should tell you that the applause, followed by the silence, followed by the laugh and the applause, was because Thierry Escaich, the organist, appeared round the wrong side of the organ and found he couldn't get round to the console. So he surreptitiously, except he was in full view of 6,000 people, walked around to the other side. He's now sitting at the console. And here comes Paavo Järvi. I don't know if he's been told about the expedition of Thierry Escaich, but all is well now. Paavo Järvi joining the Orchestre de Paris to perform Saint-Saëns' Organ Symphony.